Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It certainly is great to be back on the air with you guys, and I hope that all of you, no matter where you live in the world, did in fact have a good Christmas holiday. I believe the last time I was on the air with you guys, it might have been about a week ago this time. So, you know, to some extent, it seems like it's been a lot longer than almost a week. But my objective between now and year's end was to get on the air one more time before the new year began. So what do you know? I was able to fulfill that objective. But what I do know is that where we're going in this next podcast segment episode to Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy by M. William Phelps, we have a lot of ground to cover. But then again, we always have lots of ground to cover. But sometimes, I guess how the best way to interpret is that, you know, when I say that we have a lot of ground to cover, that could mean, you know, 5 pages of information on one particular episode, and then on the other, it could be 6. And what do you know, this podcast segment episode to Nathan Hale, The Life and Death of America's First Spy, is a 6-pager. And, you know, I know some of you are thinking, how can you cover 6 pages when you have an hour? Well, it can be done. I've done it before, and I will certainly be able to prove to you all that that I definitely am able to fulfill that objective. I do know that in this episode, we're going to talk early on about Nathan Hale going to a new school to teach. You know, he had been in Moody's, and that was quite the opposite of where he's going now. I mean, he's going to be going to New London, which it has a greater population than Moody's. Obviously, Moody's being more rural, New London being a port village. So obviously being living in a port village, or, you know, relocating to a port village, there's going to be more, activity going on, to say the least. So also in this episode, we're going to learn about 1774, not just so much the year that Nathan begins teaching at the new school. Of course, I know I might be giving some of this away, but, you know, it is important to lay some kind of foundation for where we're going. But 1774 is one of those watershed years. You know, we're not at the point just yet where shots are going to be fired around the world at Lexington and Concord come April of 1775. But 1774 is going to be one of those years where Britain's subjects in North America, being the 13 colonies, the majority of her people are going to take up matters by eventually having to convene somewhere very, how do I say it, by convening somewhere that really could be, in a sense, in the middle. It's not near the southernmost of the colonies, it's not near the northernmost of the colonies, but it will require people coming together to try to understand differences, and also come up with a word that too often in times we don't really like to hear often, and that is compromising. So we're also going to basically find out how, in the year 1774, how Nathan Hale himself is impacted by the issues around him. You know, it's easy to think that, well, what goes on in 1774 is only impacted by those whom have a large say in their government, being where they are in the colonies. But we do forget that everyday individuals like Nathan Hale are impacted by what has already unfolded in the since the time that the 7 Years' War ended in 1763, although, you know, he was not even 10 years old when that war ended, but still, many of King George III's subjects have felt the wrath of countless injustices or grievances that by the 1770s, it's, you know, many are beginning to wonder how much more can we endure before we finally could just say enough is enough. So I think it's fair to say that we better get the show on the road, given that this is a 6-pager. so that time itself doesn't basically so that time itself doesn't escape. In other words, it doesn't elude to the point where to where we've run out of time, and then we're left to wonder what we didn't get to. So here we go with our first lead-off question. What had the people of New London, Connecticut, come to expect as they eagerly awaited the arrival of Union School's new schoolmaster? Well, for starters, the people of New London expected the new teacher to come prepared and teaching essential topics from theology, or I should say religion, to languages in Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. I mean, after all, you know, when you go to school, especially in that day and time, you are, you know, teaching about religion is a very essential thing. And it's not just, well, about church and all that, but how, you know, God himself can play an important part in your daily life. I mean, we could still talk about that in today's time. But religion, I should say that in colonial times, was very vital considering how connected church and state were in pretty much all of the colonies prior to declaring rebellion against Britain. Of course, we won't be able to go any further until the latter part of the 18th century, when Thomas Jefferson is the first to unveil a proposal in Virginia that would call for the elimination of church and state. But the people of New London were looking to have a teacher take control of Union School for more than just 1 year. You know, yes, people come and go, but they want someone who's going to be around hopefully 3 years at most. I mean, maybe five, but, you know, we also have to be reminded of the fact that, you know, life expectancy is not high during this time, but what they really want is for the new teacher to be there for more than just a year, to basically have some kind of established tenure. New London, Connecticut's elders firmly believed that their port town or village needed a permanent teacher whom had the means to inspire children to go forward and become great leaders, thinkers, and maintain their allegiance behind separating from England, aka become devoted, ardent patriots. That's probably not fair. It's probably, how do I say it? I'm sure that in the port village of New London, it's probably fair to say that there could have been a few people who were loyalists, you know, loyal to the king, loyal to king and country, but the vast majority are patriots. So, yes, the elders of the New London village, they want their children to be successful, but in order to be successful, they need to have a teacher whom can inspire them to do things that perhaps others didn't think were possible, or, you know, basically take the talents that they have and use them in other settings where that perhaps that they didn't expect to be used beforehand. Prior to Nathan's arrival into New London, a select group of men within New London gave the Union School what we might think of in today's time as an extreme makeover. An extreme makeover in this case for the right reasons. So the Union School is getting, right before Nathan's arrival, the Union School is getting a new set of various furnishings, such as four windows on each side, three in the front and four in the back. I know some of that might sound odd to be mentioning, but in order for this school perhaps to be successful, wouldn't it be fair to say that maybe it needs to be relocated? Well, it just so happens that the school was relocated to the town's business district where it would be more visible and accessible. It's one thing to send your children to a school, but you want the school to be accessible, not just in terms of an easy, you know, commute, in terms of an easy walk, we should say in colonial times, but you want the school to be visible in the town so that if people are relocating to New London and they're married and have children, perhaps they could send their sons to the school. So the school is named Union. The school named Union was given a select group of men whom were all united behind doing what was best for the school as a whole. So when we think of union, we think of, you could think of people agreeing unanimously to something that's sacred to them. But in this case, the school being named Union, it was named that because all of the men whom were involved behind getting the school built, they were all united behind doing what was best for the school as a whole. October of 1774 in Connecticut is important because the Connecticut General Assembly approved the Union School's new facility despite it already being completed. The Union School is unique in another way because it's larger than what the average colonial school could accommodate for its time. This school could take up to 40 students at one time. 40 is a high number back then, folks. I think it'd probably be fair to say that maybe the average colonial school for its time in the 18th century would have been lucky to have maybe accommodated 15 or 20 kids at most. I mean, that's just my hunch. But to accommodate 40 is something that I think is not just an accomplishment, but beyond accomplishment. So for Nathan Hale, being in New London meant returning to a form of normalcy. Why normalcy? Because coming to New London meant the population was high, resulting in his being greatly visible to the greater New London society. Yes, he knew people in Moodus, but we have to remember that population was small. I mean, yes, there were those whom never forgot Nathan for what he did in terms of making a difference in the lives of their children. But coming to New London and being able to be in a classroom where he could teach up to 40 young boys at one time, he's definitely going to feel the impact for the better in ways that, some people could say go beyond the sky's ceiling. So yes, his presence will be greatly visible to the greater New London society, which equaled educating children of high-end status based upon their family's community rank. So think about it. Nathan Hale could very well be teaching children who come from upper-middle class status. He might even teach a few kids or a few boys who might come from middling status, but it's also going to be fair to say that he's going to he could cater to a few who might be the equivalent of gentry status, but all in all, he's going to get a good variety of students whom come from some unique backgrounds that will serve him well in his classroom. Now, once Nathan began teaching at Union School, did the results impress New London's townspeople? Well, we would hope the answer is yes, and it is yes. The townspeople were totally impressed by his appearance, including devotion to education. Many townspeople portrayed him as someone whom was very social, pleasant, excited, charming to New London's, even to the New London's bachelorettes, single women, whom they saw as a favorite amongst them. So I can't imagine, say, a dozen bachelorettes in New London all trying to compete for this young man who is just shy of 20 years old, but they're all trying to compete for him. I mean, think about it. Nathan Hale's a bachelor, and, of course, we don't have television back then, folks, so we can't say that, he should have auditioned for The Bachelor, but in today's modern time, maybe he should have. Not trying to get off track, but, but to think that New London's bachelorettes saw him as a favorite amongst them all, so it is fair to say that there would have been a lot of competition as to which of the bachelorettes would have had been able to have gone on a first date with him. Parents of pupils or students liked Nathan's teaching strategies, including the use of discipline. And yes, discipline was needed even back then, because it's fair to say that there would have been times when students did fail to abide by the classroom rules. I do know that one method for discipline back in colonial times was if a child did act up, that child would have worn a dunce cap. The dunce cap would have represented a means of being reminded that you had committed some form of improper action, and that by wearing a dunce cap, it was a reminder of the consequences of improper behavior. So it might be fair to say, though, that whatever discipline issues Nathan Hale may have encountered with students, it's probably fair to say they were in the minority. But he wanted his students to dedicate themselves to the curriculum he set, which in turn did result in their returning the favor or requests. He could even be found outside with the boys at Union engaging in athletics. So it's fair to say that Nathan Hale was doing more than just teaching in the classroom. He was also engaging these young men in athletics, not only just with Athletics 101, but perhaps improving upon their athleticism by taking it to another level. Despite successes in the classroom with many young students, did rebel support for buildup behind separation from England continue to mount? It did. For starters, the port of New London, where Nathan now lived, became vulnerable to enemy attack, given how close the town itself stood near the Atlantic Ocean's waters. I'll mention this again here in a little bit, but, you know, it's one thing to live in a village that's right along the water, especially that of the Atlantic Ocean. But in times of uncertainty, especially now that rebel support for buildup behind separation from England is really growing strong, say, in the northern colonies, it's one thing to have a buildup behind for rebel support behind separation from England, but you're also going to have to be able to come up with some solutions or strategies on how you can go about defending the coastline, because for all we know, we don't really know what could come of a surprise out of nowhere. So in other words, wouldn't it be fair to say that you would want to do everything there was to fortify your port village? And again, I'll talk more about that here in a little bit, but as of right now, I would say yes. I think you would want to do whatever it would take to fortify your town. But secondly, rebels throughout all of New England engaged in public demonstrations, most notably Parliament's taxation policies that did result in one famous incident from December 16th of 1773, where Bostonians, whom went about dressing up as Mohawk Indians, escorted ship officials off those three British ships of the Dartmouth, Eleanor, and Beaver. They escorted them off their ships and basically went about dumping over 300 chests of tea into the Boston Harbor come that evening of December 16th, 1773. So, you know, the British ship officials, they had to deliver the tea somewhere. They tried other places, and other cities denied them, especially Charleston, South Carolina, down in the south, and then up north in New York. So they didn't really have much other choice, but Boston was the one place they were willing to take it to, and it did turn out that there was a small population who were loyalists, whom were big fans of the tea, and this tea being Bohea and Hyoseung. So the tea that was supposed to be delivered really was only going to a small number of families, but yet they were powerful, and they there were about 9 loyalist families, and they all lived in a place that was dubbed Tory Row in Boston. I know that 2 of those families were the Hutchinsons and the Olivers, whom were very involved in Massachusetts politics. As a matter of fact, I might be mentioning one of those families here shortly. March 1774 is the month when King George III first officially learned of what happened 3 months earlier in Boston, being December of 1773. So can you imagine, okay, this incident takes place in mid-December of 1773, but it's not until 3 months later that you, as the ruler, not only of England, but the head ruler of all the other territories that you govern over, and in America, I should say, being that of North America and in the Caribbean. I will say this, people in the Caribbean actually weren't impacted by this because many in the Caribbean were loyalists. But I can't imagine finding out 3 months later of an incident that was so unsettling and so startling that now you have to ask yourself, given that over 300 chests of tea were dumped into Boston Harbor, we've got to take some kind of draconian measure against Massachusetts and perhaps New England, because they are not setting good precedents and they are making our lives all the more miserable. I mean, you know, yes, we've been kind enough to repeal various things. You know, we were kind enough to repeal the Stamp Act. We were kind enough to repeal everything on the Townshend duties. Of course, they don't like the tea, but the bottom line is, dumping over 300 chests of tea in the eyes of the Crown and Parliament is an egregious action, or I should say inappropriate. So, March of 1774, the Crown and Parliament officially began debating on how to punish the people of Massachusetts. This included introducing legislation leading to the closure of Boston's port and the relocation of the capital northward to Salem, including removal of executive power on the colonial level. The royal governor was appointed by Parliament, and juries going forward, whenever court cases were heard in Massachusetts, the juries were packed with loyalists, people sympathetic to the crown. So basically, it's fair to say that the people of Massachusetts are getting deprived of basic rights even when it comes to governmental affairs. And then again, the people of Massachusetts are saying to themselves, wait a minute, I didn't vote for this person to be on a jury. Why should this person be allowed to serve on a jury when we don't really even know him? We may know him, but yet he shouldn't be allowed to be on a jury all because of where his loyalties stand without our consent. What came about come May 13th, 1774? Now we're getting into something that's very important. It involves an individual. For those of you who've been with me for some time, you've probably heard about his name before, but it's probably been a while since I discussed about this individual last. So what comes about on May 13th of 1774? A British general by the name of Thomas Gage arrived into Boston's Long Wharf with the primary objective to take back control of Boston, given how much anarchy had taken place over the course of several months, including a few years before dating back to March 5th of 1770. And we all know what happened on the night of March 5th, 1770, the incident that broke the straw that broke the camel's back, the infamous Boston Massacre. So Gage has seen, he's heard a lot about what's going on. So the Crown feels that he is the right person to take command of the situation with the ultimate objective in terms of restoring order. So who does General Gage replace? He replaces the outgoing Massachusetts royal governor of Thomas Hutchinson. Remember, I mentioned earlier about how the Hutchinsons and the Olivers were related, two of nine Tory families that lived along an area known as Tory Row, whom all married into one another. And so I think it'd be fair to say that that's where all the old money kept in place. Well, I can tell you this much. Thomas Gage's wife is Margaret Kemble Gage. She is from America. She's from New Jersey. And Margaret Kemble Gage, I strongly recommend, if those of you who aren't familiar with Thomas Gage's wife, you should read up on her, Margaret Kemble Gage. She came from a very well-to-do New Jersey family. But her family was one that had mixed loyalties. She had some relatives who were loyalists to the crown, while she had a handful whom were patriots. So, it's one thing to marry someone from a well-to-do family, but that doesn't mean that everyone's loyalties are on the same page. For General Thomas Gage, I do know that when he arrives into Boston in May of 1774, he's in his mid-50s. And he does have strong leadership skills, which were attributed to previous years of military combat experience, most notably during the French and Indian War. Is it fair to say that Thomas Gage may have fought alongside with George Washington during the French and Indian War? Yes, they did, folks. There was one particular battle that they both fought at that did have a profound impact on each man. The battle was known as the Battle of the Monongahela in what is present-day western Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh. The Battle of the Monongahela took place on July 9th of 1755. While Thomas Gage and George Washington were not the head commanders, Washington served under a British general named Edward Braddock. Now, the objective at Monongahela was for the British forces to expel the French out of the Ohio Territory. Of course, in 1755, Ohio might as well be considered Virginia. And it was. But the British do not like the fact that the French are in Ohio and are going to do whatever it takes to drive them out. And the same maybe for the presence of Indians whom are aligned with the French. The majority of them are. There are a few Indian tribes that actually were aligned or were allied with the British. And what I found ironic some time back when learning a little bit more about Monongahela was that there were Indian tribal leaders that that gave General Edward Braddock some strong advice on how to go about doing things a little bit differently. In other words, General Edward Braddock had always been accustomed to fighting warfare traditionally. In other words, linear warfare, you have your soldiers lined up next to one another with the objective of firing a volley where within 50 to 100 yards with the primary goal of knocking down, say, 3 to 5 soldiers. All of that's good, but you can't do that all the time. And being in this wilderness, this would have been a perfect time for Braddock to have made the necessary modifications so that he would not have been thrown for major curveballs. Even George Washington himself, folks, learned a little bit about how to fight differently versus conventionally, and he himself even told Edward Braddock, General Braddock, that is, about how to go about revamping their current game plan. I hate to tell you this, folks, but General Braddock did not listen to anybody. Not only did he not listen to George Washington, he didn't listen to the Indian tribes whom could have aligned themselves with the British. Well, Braddock takes matters into his own hands, and Washington and Gage, you know, Washington's under Braddock, Gage is under another commander, but things get very ugly on July 9th, 1755, as a result of Braddock's forces being totally caught off guard by French and Indian fighters who massacred over 450 enemy troops. They massacred over 450 enemy troops, folks, via guerrilla war fighting tactics. In other words, they fought irregularly. They basically came out of nowhere. They were hiding in the trees and bushes. They came out of nowhere and started slaughtering Braddock's troops with axes, tomahawks, rifles. I'm not trying to gross you all out, but this is what happened. I mean, Braddock was simply unprepared for what happened, and it cost him dearly. Even with these guerrilla warfighting tactics, even General Braddock wasn't spared. He lost his life, too. So basically, the French and the Indians came out of nowhere and massacred the British troops to the point where they had no means of being able to prepare for what lied ahead. However, despite Braddock's death, officers like George Washington and Thomas Gage somehow were able to conduct a quick, hasty retreat that led to saving the lives of those whom were not wounded, to those whom were already wounded and clinging on for dear life. So It is fair to say, hold on just a moment here, that George Washington did have enough knowledge of how to go about modifying a situation where it really was a matter of life and death, to where a certain number of troops, their lives were saved. And had it not been for Washington and Gage's leadership, we could have been looking at a greater death toll. But to think that over 450 enemy troops were massacred, or all because General Braddock did not reinvent warfare fighting, he really did. I mean, yes, for one, he shot himself in the foot, but two, he cost the British early on in the Seven Years' War, folks, were not very sophisticated. They really struggled to keep up with the irregular style of fighting that the French and the Indians were so successful at. It wouldn't be until about 1758 or 1759 when the British finally start to get early grounds on getting the upper hand. But moving on, had the Boston Port Act gone into effect before or after General Gage's arrival into Boston? The legislation itself was signed into law on March 31st of 1774, but did not go into effect until June 1st of 1774. So we could say yes and no, but let's see, Gage arrives around the middle of May, so we're really looking at about just shy of 3 weeks by the time the Boston Port Act went into effect. The Boston Port Act is part of what's called the Intolerable Acts, or as Parliament saw it, the Coercive Acts, part of the set of five laws. The closure of the Boston port, it's very draconian. How so? Well, thousands of jobs, folks, are eliminated. You know, people's livelihoods now are at stake. You know, people who worked at the Boston port, you had your rope makers, you had people who were making cloth for that would be used for the boats, sailcloth. You had people who were vendors, you know, selling goods, you know, selling pewter, selling anything that would be of useful importance, not only as a commodity to maybe show off to people, but essentials, you know, like eating utensils or food. I mean, you can find food at the markets. I mean, that's why they, you know, have such things as farmers markets. But the bottom line is that when you eliminate thousands of jobs, what does that also result in? Widespread poverty, which also means that merchants are not able to sell their goods, and it also led to great numbers of people starving. Now, I can't imagine my livelihood being disrupted by this legislation, but now all of a sudden, what if I don't have enough money to be able to provide food for my family on the table? What are we going to do? I mean, it's not like we can just go to the nearest grocery store and pick up a handful of groceries, or go contact Instacart somewhere and say, hey, can you bring us groceries? No, those people back then didn't have that luxury. But there is some good news to report in that the other colonies, they saw that the Boston Port Act, they viewed it as a not only a detrimental blow for Boston's economy, but as far south as South Carolina, the people in the South Carolina legislature saw that the Boston Port Act, or the closure of the Boston port, for the people of South Carolina, this really concerned them tremendously, because Charleston, South Carolina, was the southern colony's largest port. So people in Charleston, South Carolina, were beginning to say, hey, if Parliament can close the port of Boston without the Massachusetts people's direct consent, then they certainly have the authority beyond our wildest imagination to come out of nowhere and decide that they would like to shut down the port of Charleston. So these ports, folks, whether it's in Boston, Charleston, Philadelphia, New York, probably Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Newport, Rhode Island, just to name a handful, these ports represent countless people's means of economic livelihood. And when that gets taken away, you know, recovery doesn't happen overnight, but so much uncertainty lies in store. And so, most notably in Virginia, I know that in other colonies, they did send ships northward to where some supplies could, in fact, be delivered to the people of Boston, but it had to be done, I would imagine, in a, it would probably would have had to have gone to Salem, or it would have had to have gone somewhere else near Boston to where the goods would not be confiscated by British authorities. Well, Britain's Intolerable Acts led men from 12 of the 13 colonies to band together by meeting in Philadelphia come September of 1774. 12 out of 13 colonies. Who decided not to come? I will tell you this, folks. The colony that did not send delegates in 1774 is Georgia, the last of the 13 colonies to be established, which was done so in 1733. Georgia is the lone colony whom didn't send delegates in 1774 due to fighting a war against the Creek Indian Nation. And if you're going to fight a war, you know, against an Indian nation here, who do you need support from, folks? You need support from the Crown and the Parliament. Because if you don't get support from them, then I think it'd be fair to say you're on your own. But Georgia is not interested in sending any delegates up to Philadelphia at this time. Had Nathan written regularly to friends and family about his new teaching position in New London? I know it seems like an odd leap there, but we are switching gears here for the time being. But the answer is yes. He talked emphatically about just how happy he was in making a difference amongst all the students he taught, including people he met whom became his friends within the port town. I think all of that's great. I think it's tremendously good to know that he is making a difference in the community itself. But yet at the same time, you have to wonder, while yes, I'm making a difference in the community, shouldn't I be perhaps making a difference elsewhere? Although Nathan's job brought him great joy, at the same time he was aware of just how tense things had become right in Connecticut, as Connecticut's citizens or people spoke out in fierce opposition towards Britain's measures, which had deprived basic fundamental rights. You know, when I think of basic fundamental rights, I think of life, being able to go about doing what you enjoy doing on a regular basis, but doing so without unnecessary government restrictions that we might find to be unconstitutional. Liberty, being able to be free from unjust practices. So, the summer of 1774 saw Nathan and his brother Enoch converse regularly about supporting the colonies in regards to injustices or the grievances that the Crown and Parliament had imposed upon their subjects. All right, this is good that both brothers are conversing regularly, because when you start conversing regularly, you are establishing a common ground, and perhaps this is just the first step towards something bigger. By the fall of 1774, what had Nathan missed tremendously? An absence of friends whom were Yale College grads or alums, given he was very anxious and eager to know what was taking place in their lives, considering it had been over a year since they all saw each other last in person. Well, we've got to remember, there's no such things as telephones, cell phones, no form of social media, but when you think about it, when you write to someone, especially in that day and age, that was a big deal, because when you got the letter, it was probably at least 3 or 5 weeks old, depending on where the letter originally sent. But you also would have hoped that by the time you'd received the letter, that the person whom wrote to you was still living. So even if the news itself maybe was 5 weeks old, it was still a big deal to read about. Nathan, along with 4 other Yale classmate grads, being Thomas Meade, James Hillhouse, John Alden, and James Willis, went about establishing a group called Quintumvirate. Quintumvirate, spelled Quintumvirate. Quintumvirate. The purpose of Quintumvirate centered upon its members meeting regularly in the years after having graduated, where matters of key importance got discussed, such as politics, commerce, the state of the 13 colonies. Quintumvirate also established to maintain and solidify members' friendships with one another. So think about this. You want to meet regularly in the years after having graduated. If you couldn't meet every year, maybe once every 2 years. Think of this as an early version of college homecoming for its time. Although he was at peace with himself in New London, Nathan did often reflect a lot about his time in Moodus, wondering why things were the opposite, including what he could have done differently. Well, I think it's fair to say that all of us sometimes wonder why we may have had to go down a different path versus where we would have hoped to have started. But I think Nathan, if I were Nathan Hale, I would have to be reminded of the fact that although Moodus was rural, there were people out there who in Moodus who did appreciate him for his devotion to the students and for making a difference in their lives. Yes, it was a smaller population, but that was not something he had control over. But what he did do was by doing the right thing and teaching those students and staying for as long as he did, even though it was a short period of time. But he got his feet wet, and he did establish a foundation that ultimately has taken him to a location where his status has been elevated, and being able to fit into a community with a population that is not only probably a little bit more diverse, but higher. What was important come August of 1774 for the Connecticut colony? Well, Silas Deane, whom was a well-known Hartford, Connecticut lawyer and a Yale graduate, including Roger Sherman and Ella Follett Dyer, all made the journey south to Philadelphia, where delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies would convene come the following month. Yes, whenever I think of Roger Sherman, I think of him as being on that, he would go on to be on that famous Committee of Five that worked together to not only draft the Declaration of Independence, but to, you know, people think Thomas Jefferson must have written the Declaration of Independence in one night. I mean, John Adams wanted a Virginian to be in charge of writing the Declaration of Independence, given that Virginia was the largest of the 13 colonies. But we should be reminded of the fact that Thomas Jefferson had to make 86 revisions, and the majority of the revisions were overseen by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams themselves. But Roger Sherman, along with Robert Livingston, were a part of the Committee of Five, and Roger Sherman would also become one of six members, one of six delegates whom signed not only the Declaration of Independence, but the U.S. Constitution. I know I'm getting a little ahead of the game, but if there is one thing that we probably should thank Roger Sherman for, he was the one that came up with that great compromise in 1787 that basically allowed for every state to have two senators regardless of size, and that numbers in the House of Representatives would be based upon each state's population. So, yes, some states had more representatives than others, but the most important thing is that every state, regardless of its size, got two senators. So make sure that whenever you hear about that, if there's one person to think of, you think of Roger Sherman for doing that. But September 5th of 1774 is important because that marked the opening day where delegates probably got to meet one another. That is, delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies. They probably started getting to know one another. They probably began discussing some issues of key importance. I do know, based upon having read a book on John Adams sometime back, that the first group of delegates he met at the First Continental Congress were those from Virginia and as far south as South Carolina. Someone had told him that you really need to get yourself acquainted with the South Carolina delegation for various reasons. And as much as John's cousin Samuel wanted independence, there were those in Congress at this First Continental Congress who told Mr. Samuel Adams that, hey, look, you are entitled to have your opinion on matters, but you also need to watch how much you talk about with regards to independence, because, you know, there are a fair number of people here whom are still seeking reconciliation. They don't like the injustices that Parliament had imposed on previous years, but we're still hoping that some kind of reconciliation can be made. So they met in Carpenter's Hall, and my wife and I, when we went to Philadelphia 2 years ago, one of the places we did see was Carpenter's Hall, where the first Continental Congress met. Carpenter's Hall is named for Carpenter's Company that got established in 1724. And it was at this facility where the First Continental Congress met and convened all the way until October 26th of 1774. So the First Continental Congress convened, folks, for 7 weeks and 2 days. 7 weeks and 2 days, folks, that's a lot. Now, I don't know if they met every day, but to have been there for 7 weeks and 2 days, just a little over 7 weeks, is remarkable. The president of the First Continental Congress was a Virginian named Mr. Peyton Randolph, whom I've learned a great deal about for quite some time, especially when I've gone to Williamsburg. And it just so happens that, believe it or not, Mr. Rebel Rouser, in terms of advocate for independence, Mr. Samuel Adams, he was the one that actually nominated Peyton Randolph of Virginia to be the president of the Continental Congress. So I think it would be fair to say that the moderates, whom are seeking reconciliation, actually would have had to have applauded Mr. Samuel Adams for at least being flexible in allowing Mr. Peyton Randolph of Virginia the role of president of the Congress. And even Peyton Randolph himself at this time probably is hoping that some kind of reconciliation could be made. Peyton Randolph, I thought it was interesting here, he served a majority of time at the First Continental Congress until October 22nd. He stepped down due to health reasons. And yes, it is fair to say that probably there were delegates in attendance who did experience some health issues. I mean, Philadelphia can be very hot in the summertime, but I think it's probably fair to say that even in early September, they were probably dealing with some humid weather. Now, I found it interesting that the person who filled in for the last few days of the First Continental Congress was a South Carolinian named Henry Middleton. I didn't know this until recently, but of course, whenever we think of the person who ultimately replaced Peyton Randolph later on down the road being Mr. John Hancock, that's usually our answer that we know of, but we do forget that someone else did replace Peyton Randolph in the First Continental Congress, and that was Henry Middleton of South Carolina, who was from a prominent family, and his son, Arthur Middleton, would go on to sign the Declaration of Independence. The delegates were united on some matters, but not 100% with everything. If we take a look at individuals such as Mr. John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, Mr. John Jay of New York, Mr. Edward Rutledge of South Carolina, these men were what we would consider the moderates, whom sought reconciliation between the colonies and Britain. If we take some firebrand figures like Mr. Patrick Henry of Virginia, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, to John and Samuel Adams of Massachusetts, they all opposed any idea behind reconciling with Britain due to unfair parliamentary practices that had taken place since the aftermath of the Seven Years' War. And yes, these individuals would have been in full opposition, but yet at the same time, they were probably coached by others around them to be careful as to how much to say in terms of opposition, given that, well, yes, the delegates did agree on certain things, but they didn't agree on everything 100%. So if you can't agree on everything, and knowing that you can't agree on some things, Is it fair to say that delegates from the First Continental Congress prevailed with compromising versus advocating independence? Yes. The First Continental Congress created the Continental, or what's known as the Articles of Association. This called for a trade boycott against British merchants, resulting in economic sanctions imposed on all British imported and exported goods. Imported coming in, goods exported going out. The boycott on the British goods was intended to get Parliament to repeal all laws under the Intolerable Acts. Hey, we don't mind reconciling with you guys, but if you could repeal the Intolerable Acts, then we could also lift the boycott on all British imported goods coming in and British exported goods going out. Did anyone from Quintembury go all out and push Nathan Hale to take a stand behind the colonists' current struggle against Britain? Yes, someone in the group named James Hillhouse wrote a letter to Nathan advising him to take a more active role in the current conflict involving Britain. So yes, you know, Nathan is aware of what's going on. And yes, he can talk, you know, one can talk all they want about how they are an ardent patriot and or how they are all for independence. That's great if you want to talk about it left and right, but maybe you need to do something else. Maybe it's fair to say that James Hillhouse, and he may not be the last one to say this. Of course, this wasn't said back in 1774, but not to get off track, but I have watched footage on various occasions of John F. Kennedy's presidential inauguration from 1961. And at the very end, he said the following: "I ask my fellow American citizens, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Perhaps the other gentlemen from Quintembury were encouraging Nathan Hale to not sit back and say, "Well, what can America do for me?" But maybe I need to ask the following instead: what can I go about doing for my country as this crisis continues to unfold with no clear ending resolution in sight? Well, the winter of 1774-1775 is very tough for Nathan Hale and his family, because sadly, tragedy struck the family as Alice Adams, Nathan's stepsister, lost her husband to consumption. I'm not talking about food or drinking here, folks, but consumption back then was a disease linked, or better known as tuberculosis, caused by bacteria that normally attacks the lungs. Early 1775 saw many of Nathan's fellow Yale alum complain about his lack of writing correspondence, which had lacked solid consistency. Well, for all of Nathan's accolades and successes in teaching and all that, I think it is fair to say that, you know, even those whom are the best, who, you know, do have their flaws. So in January 11th, 1775, Ebenezer Williams writes a letter accusing Nathan of neglecting former classmates and peers. This is where you have to wonder, is it appropriate to say everything that's on your mind? Well, in February of 1775, Nathan Hale wrote to Richard Sill, a fellow student whom Nathan met in New Haven, advising that he would modify his inconsistent writing skills. Perhaps this might be like the equivalent of a New Year's resolution. Richard Sill wrote to Nathan saying that the Yale campus had strong military presence, with such phrases of "constantly sounds with poise your firelock, cock your firelock." Signs, folks, that war with Britain is inevitable. What really made Nathan see firsthand that signs of war were coming? For starters, he observed cannons getting moved into the port of New London. You know, early on I said how New London was vulnerable to an attack from an outsider. Well, now as tensions continue to mount and rise, it's fair to say that that government officials are taking the first right steps in moving cannons into the port of New London, and these cannons are pointing outward into the harbor. So in other words, we're going to have cannons ready to go should in the event an enemy ship makes its way close to shore, and we can fire off the cannons as a means of deterring the ship from inflicting any kind of harm, not only on, say, government officials, but just on the greater, but just towards the greater public in general. Nathan Hale observed the Connecticut legislature assembling military divisions. These military divisions could be militia units that are being getting ready to be established. Should in the event something major happen, the militia will be ready to be called up at a moment's notice. Nathan was very eager and impressed behind what he saw, to where a change like never before would be seen, altering the lives of many, both old and young, including where people's allegiances stood within Greater New London, knowing the town was comprised of many successful business people and as well as wealthy elite. So Nathan Hale now sees for himself that revolution is in the air. I mean, he's known about it for some time, but seeing firsthand that cannons are getting moved into the port of New London and they're being pointed outward towards the harbor, that's a sign that it might be time to take a stand, and it also would be a time to do the following. Okay, what can I do for my country here? And that would be to answer the call of duty and go about getting enlisted. To me, that is a great first step in contributing to what will eventually become a greater war effort. Well, folks, we've done it. We have covered all six pages of this podcast segment episode. When I'm on the air again next, we're going to learn about the importance behind such things as May 10th of 1775, as well as June 15th of that year. We're also going to learn a little bit about communication from a militaristic standpoint early on in 1775. It will involve Nathan receiving letters from friends whom have already seen combat in Massachusetts. Well, thank you for your time, as always. It's always a joy to be able to chat with you guys and podcast. Without you all, I'm not sure where I would be. But if I'm not on the air again before this year is over, I hope all of you have a great new year wherever you may live in the world. And I hope to be back on the air come the very start of 2024. Take care for now, and wherever you all may live, stay safe.